My guest today on this Roundhouse Making Space podcast is the world-famous and much-loved choreographer and dancer Akram Khan. At just 13, he was in Peter Brook's company for a groundbreaking retelling of the Mahabharata. His solo performance Desh and his many other works have been seen by hundreds of thousands of people, if not more, worldwide. He has collaborated with musicians, actors, sculptors, designers, and many others for his work, including people like Juliette Binoche and Anthony Gormley. His profile, however, increased dramatically when he choreographed and danced in the Abide With Me section of the London 2012 Olympic Games opening ceremony. 10 years ago, the Roundhouse was proud to be one of the commissioners of his work Until the Lions, created on a round stage surrounded by the audience. Until the Lions received 5-star reviews and toured the world to great acclaim. Akram, it's a great honour to be with you today to talk on this Making Space podcast. For these podcasts, I've been trying to ask questions that may have not been asked before. So I suppose I'm saying, please forgive me if we go into kind of strange realms of discussion. So I was wondering, first of all, is when you first knew what dance was and that you were a dancer?
That's a question that goes back a long time. Wow. First of all, thank you, Marcus. It's such a privilege to be on this podcast, especially with the Roundhouse. It was sacred for me to work in such a space that just the organization, just the arrangement of a circular space itself suggests ancient times. So it was brilliant for me to present the work in this ancient space that is very, very present and involves so many new people and young people and everyone, really. So going back to the question, I would say my consciousness has always been slower than my body. My mental consciousness has always been different speed, operated in a very different speed to my physical consciousness, if you like. And so my mental consciousness realized that dance was such a thing was when I saw my mother dance. And I would say, I don't remember it, but the moment I do remember was when I was about 5 or 6. But apparently I was watching my mum and learning dance from her from the age of 3. So that I don't remember. But having glimpses of memories, I remember the feeling of seeing my mother dance in a sari in the garden of our backyard. But I would say, really, in all honesty, it was Michael Jackson. Watching him for the first time, I would say, was the catalyst for me to go, I want to dance.
And how old were you, do you think?
I would say probably 7 or 8.
And can you remember the movement? Was it the moonwalk or was it something?
No, I think it was him, you know, with his brothers.
Yeah, yeah, Jackson 5.
Jackson 5. And this video came on, you know, on TV and black and white. And he was at the center of it. And he didn't look so different in age to the time I was. I don't know how old he was, but it was a young kid with his older brothers, men, really. And here's this kid at the center of it. And what the reaction of the audience and his magnetism, I remember going, this is what I want to do.
And you remember that you wanted to do this, but when did you realize that actually you were a dancer?
Much later, I would say after, really, really much later, when I came back from working with Peter Brook, because I left, as you said, at 13 to work with him, and then I came back just roughly around 15, and I got lost for a long time, you know, coming back to normal life, school, education. And then it was a tough period for me because I was in a bubble for a year and a half with actors who had already decided that this is their life. And coming home back to normality, going to school, wearing a uniform, learning stuff that it didn't make sense to me what I was learning and why I was learning. So I think After being in the garage, my dad's garage, where I spent a year bunking off school, which my parents didn't know at the time, I spent 10 hours a day. And then my mother just went, when she found out, she said, "You could have done anything. You could have gone out with your mates. You could have bunked properly. Instead, you chose to train for 9 to 10 hours on your own in isolation." And that's when I went, yeah, there must be something there. My body and mind is saying something, which I, you know, for me, it wasn't a choice. That's what I'm trying to say. It never felt like a choice that I decided. It was a calling, and nothing else made sense.
I mentioned Anthony Gormley. I've interviewed him for one of these podcasts, and I was talking to him about what humanity was, where our creativity comes from, and how it is wonderful to see children making something with their hands, dancing with their feet, making music. These are the things that we start with in the world, play, and we do it through dance and music and making things. Why do you think humans, or how do you think humans became, and maybe we aren't, but maybe we are, uniquely creative? Where do you think that comes from?
Yeah, I mean, it's I would say it's really specific to my thinking. I wouldn't dare to say that it's the same opinion or starting point of a reason for other artists. Perhaps it is, I don't know. But for me, fundamentally, play came from listening to stories.
Ah.
It's about storytelling. And I think that's what is at the core of what it means to be human, that we're born storytellers, all of us, every single one of us, whether we're in arts or not. It transfers and changes into other genres for some people, most people, and a few lucky ones, I would say, get to be in art. You're a storyteller yourself because you're drawn to certain artists that tell stories in certain ways that resonate with you. And the same for me. So storytelling was really a part of my upbringing, but it was a very chaotic storytelling, and that's what defined me, I would say. And that's where the creativity came about, because we use stories to make sense of the world that we live in. Otherwise, the world won't make sense to us. We use stories to get through or try to understand trauma. We use stories to celebrate. So storytelling is at the heart of all creativity. Otherwise, there's no reason to search, be curious, or the only reason you're curious is because something is saying something that's drawing you towards it. And the act of saying or doing is storytelling in its basic form.
It's really interesting you've started talking about story, because I had a couple of questions about stories, because all the podcast guests for this Making Space series have talked about story being at the center of everything. Everything else is peripheral. The story is the thing, whether it's lighting, design, movement, it's all about the story. And you have just reaffirmed that, because I therefore don't need to ask my question. But I do want to jump into something else, which is, I don't know if you remember, but many years ago we were sitting and I told you a story about the architect designer Ron Arad. And I'd been sitting in Ron Arad's studio across the road from the Roundhouse. I asked him about his early life in this country and when he was in like 20, and he had got a job with an illustrator. He lived in the illustrator's house and he kind of became part of the family. And I said, "What about the family? Are you still in touch with them?" This is like 40 or 50 years before. And he said, "No, I've lost contact like 30 years ago. And, you know, I've been thinking about them," he said. And I said, "Oh, tell me about them." And at that moment, there was a knock on the door, and this old man came in with a younger man, and it was the man that he had been talking about at that very
No
moment.
way.
It was
That's
absolutely
amazing.
extraordinary. And then you told me, and I just wonder if you could share this story, because I think about it quite often, about the connectivity of the world, about when you're in Sydney. And it was such an extraordinary story that I wonder if you wouldn't mind sharing it, because I do have some questions that relate to it afterwards.
Absolutely. Sharing this story, I mean, the story itself was pivotal for my, in my own creative world. It really changed the kind of stories I wanted to tell from this experience that I had in Australia. So I was performing with Juliette Binoche at Sydney Opera House. And I've performed there before, but it was particularly in this event. And we had few shows. And one of the shows, the hotel wasn't far, but after the show, I wanted to get a hotel back. I think I was exhausted or something. And so I waited for the taxi. The taxi arrived. I opened the door. And as I opened the door, it was the first time in my life, to my knowledge, at that time, that I wanted to hear my father's voice. And I don't have a relationship with my father over the phone. It's very practical, usually. It's my mother who I would normally call over the phone. But for the first time, I could feel the urge to speak to my father. Anyway, as I opened the door, a rude couple behind me, I'm calling them rude because they got in the taxi as if I was there to open the door for them. So they got into the taxi and they were baffled because they kept looking at me and going, is that Akram Khan? So wasn't he just on stage? And so they closed the door and I was like, that's so rude. And they rolled down the window and said, are you Akram Khan? And I said, maybe. I didn't want to say, because I didn't want to be rude just in case they were the audience members. So I was in a predicament, really. And I just kind of was a bit aloof and said, maybe. And they said, you're just on stage now. I said, maybe. And they realized that I was being sarcastic. And anyway, they said, thank you so much for the show, rolled up the window and left.
They didn't give you the cab.
No, they just pulled up and left. And so the next taxi arrived 5 minutes later. I checked behind me just to make sure that there's not another couple thinking I'm there to open the door. There wasn't. And I got into the taxi. And the first thing I did was told him, the driver, where to go in English. And I called my father. And I said, hello, Abba. And I didn't know what time it was. I know I woke him up. It's the middle of the night, maybe, or something, early morning. And he said, what do you want? And this was all in Bengali, because I speak to him in Bengali. And I didn't have an answer for him. I said, I don't know. And he paused and he said, are you in trouble with the police? And I said, no, not at all. He goes, then why did you call me? Do you want to speak to mum? I said, no. He said, then what do you want? And I couldn't answer him. There wasn't a reason or words. I couldn't. It was an instinct. And do you need money? And I said, Abba, you know what? Don't worry. I don't need money. I'm not in trouble with the police. Go back to sleep. I'm so sorry I woke you up. And he was baffled, I could tell. So we put the phone down. A moment later, the driver asks me in Bengali. So obviously he's Bengali. Is your father's name Mushrif Hussain Khan? And I was like, that's really surreal, because at no point in my conversation, at any point in my conversation, at any time, would I use my parents' name directly to them. I'll just say dad or mom, Abba or Amma. So I know I hadn't used his name. So I was very suspicious at this point. And I said yes. And I kind of laughed and I said, how do you know that? He goes, can you answer me one more question? And I was like, this is taking a really weird direction. And he said, is your father Mushrif Hussain Khan? That Mushrif Hussain Khan, who's from Al-Ghijr. Now, Al-Ghijr is a village, Marcus, that I'm joking, but I'm not joking. Roughly 200 people in the world probably that know that place. If you ask somebody in Bangladesh, do you know Al-Ghijr? Unless you're from there, you wouldn't know. So I would say 195 of these people at that time in the taxi, I'm guessing, knew that place because they're from there. The other five are my mother, my sister, myself, my mom, and I'm assuming this taxi driver. So at this point, I didn't answer him. And I said, who are you? And he gave me his name. And I said, how do you know this? So in a sense, I was indirectly confirming it. He says, how do you know this? But he was like really persistent and saying, can you answer me? Please, please. He pled with me. And I was thinking, why? Why would the CIA want me? What have I done? I'm just a storyteller. I started to get really, really paranoid, and he wouldn't answer me. Like, how does he know this information? He kept asking me to confirm it. Is he from Algichur? And I said, stop the car. He stopped the car. I was very disrespectful, I have to say. I was very, very, I was very tense actually, because it's very specific information out of the blue. I opened the door, I got out, and I heard him kind of cry, really. I think he was crying. And I was like, if I walk away from this, I'll never know. So I got back in the taxi and I said, yes, he's from Al-Kijor. Now you tell me how you know this. And he says, I've been looking for your father for over 30 years. We grew up together in this village called Al-Kijor. But I was wondering how he made this connection. And he said, and you were performing at the opera house, but I knew, I didn't know if it was you, but I knew your father had this famous son who was a dancer who was performing in opera houses around the world, because I read the newspaper in Bangladesh. And I just thought it was, you are the son of my best friend, my childhood friend. So I called my father immediately. He said, what do you want? Stop waking me up. What's wrong now? And I said, Abba, do you know, excuse me, what's your name, by the way? How would my father know you? He said, Billu Bhai. Billu is his nickname. Only mostly my father called him that. And Bhai means brother. So I said, Abba, there's this guy here who has been looking for you. His name is Billu Bhai. Hello? Hello? Abba, are you there? And it's the first time that I can recall that I heard my father cry. So there you have it. That's the story.
That's the, I mean, it's kind of breathtaking story, and thank you for sharing it because it is so deeply rooted in you, I know, and it has such an impact on you. But I ask about that as I have a feeling many of the kind of extraordinary artists I've had the privilege to meet, including yourself, are connected to something deeper, something out of the reach of many of us, or maybe in reach, but we just don't know how to reach. I recently heard Kay Tempest talk at an event here about the Roundhouse about channeling the ideas and the words and the stories as if they existed out there and they just had to collect them and bring them together. Do you have to be in a certain state of mind when you're creating?
I think the most valuable time, and I hate saying this, of when I feel like I'm in a good, really good place to be creative, is when I am vulnerable and when I'm drowning. And one has to find the pleasure in drowning, because it's in the, I always say this, you have to find the pleasure in drowning. All artists have to find the pleasure in drowning. Because when you're in the known, you are living a sense of an illusion. Because Marcus, you and I don't know after this conversation what will happen in our lives. From the moment you finish, I could walk out into the street and get killed. Anything can happen at any moment. But we have this illusion, this sense that we are in control. And we spend most of our lives trying to control that, to feel like we're in control. Like we're in control of freedom, like we're in control of our choices, and up to a point we are. But I think it was Bob Dylan who said, the birds are only free, something like that. The birds are only free as far as the sky will hold them. So they're free, but they're free within a canvas, which is the sky. And ever since you're born, our trajectory, the way it's designed, is to feel like you're in control and to be in control. But it's when you're not in control that reveals who you really are. It's when I'm in an unfamiliar place that makes me feel uncomfortable because I'm not in control of that place. It's an unknown. It's a Xenos. It's a stranger. And so, in a sense, that zone, which happens to me by chance, it's not a, I'm not in control of it. I don't put myself in trauma. It's probably because something is going on in my life or around me in the world that forces me to ask the question, what stories do I want to tell here? And in, within that story, what do I need to say in response to the world or the place that I'm living at? And there's the controlled version, and then there's the subconscious version, because it's the stuff we cannot see is really, and it's the stuff that we do not say is what we're really saying, that we really want to say. And it's such a strange thing because we're taught all our lives to communicate, but the way the society and the civilization has constructed itself is actually you don't say what you really want to say. You say everything that hides what you really want to say.
And the British are particularly good at that.
I know, I mean, I would say the Bangladeshis as well.
I read an interview with you, or maybe it was I saw an interview when you were talking about when you were a child, the only time you were still was in a dance class. And it reminded me of the famous art educator, Sir Ken Robinson, who talked about Gillian Lynn. And Gillian Lynn's parents had taken her to the doctor because Gillian Lynn could never keep still and, you know, couldn't focus or anything like that. And the doctor, who was obviously enlightened and brilliant, said, "Your child isn't ill, she's a dancer." Why is it that you were still? Is this you're still in your mind or still in your body or both? Why was it the only time when you were dancing, do you think?
I think there's many reasons, but the strongest reason I would say was because it's a wavelength. It's channeling a certain wavelength. It's like my son, who's 11 now, but he has the same condition, let's say, a problem that I had, which is not a problem. It's just that when we talk about stillness, I'm talking about a sense of entire focus. It's a sense of focusing on one thing because it's really connecting with you deeply. And he does that with opera. It's so surreal, right? Opera was on the television by chance. And we got worried because we said, where's Kenzo? We're not hearing him because he's screaming, shouting, running around. Very, very explosive, can't control himself. And suddenly the house was quiet and we were in the garden. So we came in, and actually, I think he was around five, and he was standing still like a zombie looking at this opera. In we're from both you and I from the arts, but I couldn't find a reason why this particular genre, because I haven't exposed him to it, allowed him to focus, and we were going, hello, Kenzo, you okay? And he zoned in. He zoned out of the world and zoned into this. And I think the same thing happened to me many times with dance. And the huge struggle I had, particularly my mother, of teachers complaining that this was the review, the constant review from every single teacher in every single parents' evening. And it went on all the way until parents' evening didn't exist for me. When I, went to college and stuff, there was no parents' evening, but all my childhood. He's super, the problem is not that he's not smart. The problem is that he's not interested. He's just not interested.
But this is something about our education system. And I know this government is doing a lot to reimagine our art and creative subjects in schools and some really great work going on. But one size fits all obviously doesn't work for everybody. It's funny you say that. I took my son to an opera when he was like 12 or something at English National Opera with some of those cheap seats. It was absolutely amazing. And I thought, I don't know if he's going to like this. And he was dumbstruck, absolutely dumbstruck by it and loves it. I've been several times since. But actually, you're doing something which you're doing something in this interview, which you're connecting to something deeper, because you are answering my next questions before I get to them. You don't know this, but my next question was about what happens to you when you're on stage. What happens to time? Because you talked about this in relation to your son, but when I was a kid, I played in a youth orchestra, I played on stage, and I remember one time that something very strange happened to time, and I didn't know what's going on. I didn't know where I was. I was in a different world. I was floating, and it was extraordinary. And this happened to me again when I was a kid at the Edinburgh Festival, saw a concert, and I said to my dad, why have we come to this concert when it was so short? I thought it was 20 minutes. I said, it's absolutely brilliant, but why have we come to a whole concert? It was 20 minutes. He said, no, that was an hour and a half long. But what happens to time to you when you're on stage?
I think you just described it brilliantly. You go from a generic sense of time. You shift from generic human-made, man-made clock time, the industrial time, the money-making time, the illusion of controlling time, an arbitrary time, to when you're on stage, to it shifts very quickly, rapidly to deep time, which is ocean time, which is life and death time, which is ritualistic time, which is seasonal time, which is feminine time, which is spiritual time, which is sacred time. So you're shifting from one, because the way we see time is from the range of when we're born to whatever we think, guessing of how long we will live, which is so minute to Earth's time, let alone the galaxy's time. But we can comprehend it, we can understand the information, but it's not knowledge. It's just somebody saying to you that these are the facts, and you exist in this small time. But it's not knowledge, it's information. The difference between information and knowledge is when that information becomes experiential. When you experience that. That's why that story of the taxi driver affected me, because it was deep time, because it was experiential. So being on stage, what it does is it shifts time from being an information, like, sorry, Marcus, I've got to go because it's this time. I'll be back from a break in 15 minutes. That's a man-made time.
Yeah, manufactured time.
A construct. Yeah. Manufactured time. Yeah. There we are. And what happens on stage is that it shifts from that manufactured time to something that becomes experiential. And so you experience time from not your perspective. Roundhouse is special, but Roundhouse, the stage is not sacred until you have 1,000 people giving their time and focus into that space. The space can be anywhere, but what makes it so special is that everyone around is focusing in the center of it. So we call that sacred. Oh, it felt so sacred. It's only sacred because 1,000 or 2,000 people are giving you their focus and time that is not in the manufactured time, but in the deep time. So that's what happens. You suddenly click into ocean time. And like you said, an hour and a half can feel like 20 minutes.
You're doing that thing again, which is answering the next question.
I'm so sorry.
But before I go on to the next question, do you feel yourself 100%? Do you feel that you are yourself 100% when you're on stage? Or do you feel yourself more to be yourself on stage than you do when you're in normal life?
That's a really interesting question. I would say the most honest I've ever been is when I'm on stage. The most truthful. Because you have everything to lose. You know, my daughter and I were in the car yesterday, and, you know, she's doing really well in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. She's only 13. She's become a world champion. She's European champion and world champion. And, you know, she's got a competition coming up at the end of May And you know, it's a kid. It's really funny because she's only 13, and I'm in arenas where people don't know who I am, but they know I'm the father of Sayuri Khan, right? And that's so, between us, it frustrates the hell out of me because I want to say, "Don't you know who I am?" That's my ego speaking. But on the other hand, it's such a beautiful experience to go, you're just a part of her journey. She's the star here. And she, you know, it's at the end of May, she's competing in this tournament. And she was like, "Oh, Papa, I don't enjoy the competition because everybody's there and everybody's present." And I said, "It's, we have different rule sets, but you have a referee or two referees. The reason I perform on stage," I was explaining to her, "I used to say I hated it. I hated it when I was growing up, because you've got to understand, if there's a thousand audience, there's a thousand referees.
A thousand
You don't
judges.
have one referee. You have a thousand referees, and how do you determine when you win or lose? Because each person, there's no rule set. Each person has their own way of being a referee and their own taste. So you have a thousand referees with no rule sets. How do you convince a thousand people that you've won?" And whereas in her competition, I think it's much more harder, but you still have one referee and the rule sets are clear. There's a bunch of rule sets to know why you're winning on points or why you're losing. On stage, you don't have that rule set. It's by the individual referee and their rule sets that they've set up of what they think is a good dance, what they think communicates well, what they think is bad. It's terrifying. But when you put yourself, when you find the pleasure in drowning, you'll realize why people, they're not insane. They're not insane. There's a reason why people are willing to climb up the Everest mountain or the Mount Everest or any mountain, knowing that they could die at any moment, knowing that many people before them have died. Why they're still willing to go up that mountain is because when you're at the threshold of life and death, and for me, going on stage is a huge death, has the possibility to be a huge death, not physically, but your entire existence, especially if that's the only thing you love. You've invested everything, that becomes your world, and knowing that you could die at any moment on stage. But when you're at there, at the threshold of it, that for me, at that moment, you are living. Everything else is not living.
I'm married to a musician, and I think she's 100% her when she's on stage. She's connected to something which is far deeper than she experiences in normal society. And I think you've summed that up very well. I believe you started your earliest dancing was in folk dance. And it made me think about the earliest ancient dances, which was probably like earliest theatre, which was probably under a tree, shading the dancers from the heat, in the round, audiences surrounding the performers. It may have been some ritual, but it was ancient and it came out of the earth, maybe, or it may have been something to do with the birds, or something to do with the real world. So when the Roundhouse and the Round Venues Network commissioned you to make a piece for In the Round, which is, a central stage in a venue with the whole audience completely surrounding you, you chose probably a lesser known element of the Mahabharata as your inspiration. And I wondered if the storytelling of the Mahabharata connected somewhere deep inside you to the ancientness of the dance forms that you started your life with.
Absolutely, for sure. I mean, you know, when you enter a space to learn to study Indian classical dance, you have to bow to the floor. That's the first thing you're taught before dancing. Then you bow to the people around you. And this is just a normal class. This is my first class, like officially. And I was like, what's the purpose of this? And I never understood what that was. And it's because you're treating the space, by doing that, you start to realize you're treating the space as a sacred space. You take your shoes off when you come to that space, whether it's a studio or not. I think the Roundhouse and the Round Network was terrifying for many reasons, partly because I got used to the fourth wall. I could still escape if things went wrong. I could escape through the wings, at least psychologically. I could hide behind the wings, cry about it, and then get back on stage like nothing happened. And also, I'm showing you, even though I was talking about truth, there's nothing more truthful than being in the circular space because there's no angle that you can hide. Every part of your body in every angle is being observed. And that was the most terrifying thing about doing the round. Because what I realized is we've designed, the modern world has designed storytelling to be from a particular angle. So all choreographic modes of modern times has been making it towards the front, towards a particular direction. So, artists like Trisha Brown, who really bent the rules and started to change how we saw dance and experienced dance, movement, how we experienced movement through other perspectives, through another area. Like, there's a whole thing in The Rooftop that she did with her back. Nobody's seen, like, how often do you see a choreography where the dancer's got their back to you most of the time?
Never.
So, no. So we always, again, there's me talking about truth, but it's really a contradiction because at the same time, we feel truthful on stage because you're at your most vulnerable. But at the same time, there's an element of dishonesty because you're showing your best side. In the round, I had nowhere to hide. And I wasn't so worried for the project itself, the story that we were saying, that we were expressing, but I was more worried that people are going to see me now and my faults because I haven't configured the other side. I haven't configured this side. They're going to see part of the way I do the movement from an angle that I've never, ever had to show. And I think psychologically, that was really
But it
terrifying.
reminds me, I went to see Bobby McFerrin, the great American musician, in La Comette round venue, which you performed in Châlons-en-Champagne. And Bobby McFerrin did his first ever In the Round show, and he was getting the audience to sing, and he's getting groups of people.
Amazing.
And I was lucky enough at the end to go and have a quick word. And I said, "So what was it like working in the round, thinking that this is going to be great? I can book him for like six shows in the Roundhouse and it's going to be amazing and it's going to be the great thing in London. Everyone's going to talk about it." He said, "I absolutely hated it. I'm never going to do it again," because he was felt so exposed. He felt he couldn't navigate it. He was so used to playing to that audience. Now, what I would say is that you cracked it. Not many people have. And it is a really brave thing for an artist to do, to get up on that stage, a round stage, and be seen from every angle. One of the things I love most of all about being in a round space, and particularly the Roundhouse, it's deep and it's ancient, as we talked about, is that you see other people watching as well. And you have a relationship with other members of the audience, which you never do when you're just lined up next to each other. So you're seeing other people's expressions and reflecting their emotions on what they're seeing in front of them. And it's time disappears in that. It's like a big clock as well, a big round. And we have 24 pillars in the Roundhouse main space, like the hand of the clock ticking round. But in the middle, you were creating something that was, again, deep and ancient. It premiered, I remember, on the 12th of January, 2016, so 10 years ago. 1,800 people, one of our biggest ever in the round audiences, and it sold out completely that run. You came back a few years later, completely sold out. You may remember that it was snowing on that first night, and you and I were giving a post-show talk, and I was interviewing you, and we said to the audience, "Look, you might as well go home. The tubes are probably going to get stopped, and there's chaos outside." And 1,000 people stayed behind to listen. But I think one of the things that I went away afterwards and had to think about what Until the Lions, and I found the quote which said, "The Until the Lions have their own historians, the history of the hunt will always glorify the hunter." Seems even more relevant today, doesn't it? That phrase.
Absolutely. I have to give credit to Kartika Nair, who was the writer of this beautiful book. And she, it was really in conversations with her because she had approached me. That's what started this idea of doing this particular niche story of Amba, because she was writing about female characters in the Mahabharata and she wanted to give voice to them and empower them. So she really triggered that for me, you know. Otherwise, perhaps I would have chosen another character, but it was her who said, "Look, I'm looking at this. Would you, I'm writing a collection of poems. Would you want to respond to this? I would love you if you could respond to this." And she suggested Amba and Shikhandi, the lead character. And I think that's what really triggered me to look into this. And what perfect opportunity then to be in the round. Why? Because she was looking at female characters. The way our civilizations have set it up is, it's really weird because the way I was taught, and it's wrong, but the way I was taught was that men, the way they connect is in armies and in social events, really is side by side, shoulder to shoulder,
Like an audience.
like an audience. So you don't confront like this. But women apparently confront, their setup is like this. You look into each,
Right.
you're facing each other. And if anything, the round space is that. It breaks down the patriarchal concept. So it's not male female or men and women, it's the patriarchal concept. It breaks it down to the matriarchal concept.
Again, you're doing that thing where you're answering the questions I'm about to ask you, which is my next one, and I'm really glad you came onto this, is that through your work, you've told many stories about women from, well, Until the Lions, Giselle, Thikra, your new Night of Remembering with 12 professional dancers and 40 local women. Now, Lady Macbeth, just been on in your new work in Denmark. Do you feel magnetized towards working to showcase important or the importance of women in your storytelling? Why do you have this focus?
It's got nothing to do with me. I can't take credit for that. I would blame it all on one person, and that was my mother. As simple as that. She was the one, you know, she's a myth collector. She collects myths. So ever since I was a child, she told me Chinese myths, Greek myths, some of African myths, the Mahabharata, myths from Islam, myths from Judaism, Christianity, some of European myths as well, folk myths. And so what she did was she didn't keep it to herself. She would tell me this, my sister and I, she would tell me this story every night when we used to stay in her bed. Every night before we would go to sleep, she would tell me a different, she would tell both of us a different myth. The problem being here, when I grew up and I went to university, I started arguing, debating, or heated discussions, arguing really, with the majority of people, and I was outnumbered every time because I was like, no, that's not how the story goes. And they would all collectively disagree with me and say, no, we know the story. What my mother did, which she didn't really, I didn't figure out until much, much later in my career, was she didn't tell me the story from Adam's perspective. She told me from Eve's perspective. She didn't tell me the story of Jesus from Jesus's perspective. She told me through Mary Magdalene's viewpoint. She didn't tell me the story from Bhishma's perspective. She would tell me the story from Amba's perspective. And the list literally goes on that all the stories she told me was from a female protagonist or antagonist, but mostly protagonist. And then many years later, I said, why did you do that? Because I came into conflict with all my mates because they kept saying, no, your version is wrong. And she said, because most of the myths that will come in front of you will be written by men. She wanted to plant a seed of empathy. And that seed of empathy can only come to you, can only be born in you, is if you have a more 360 perspective.
Ah, yes. Well, thank goodness for your mother. Thank goodness for all our mothers, actually, for you from collecting those stories, remembering them, and then championing them. Now, I've got a quick fire round of questions, which are literally a couple of word answers, and I
Okay.
might follow up. What was your first job?
Working in my dad's restaurant.
Did you enjoy
Hated it.
it? Last time you laughed until you cried.
In secret, watching Buster Keaton.
Oh, fantastic. I love Buster Keaton. That's
Genius.
absolute genius. Your favorite music artist?
Oh, I don't know. I'd still say Tom Waits.
Tom Waits, right.
Yeah, but also I have so many. Yeah, Tom
I
Waits.
met him once. That was an interesting moment.
Amazing as
Yeah,
well.
he's amazing.
You see why I want a deep voice?
Yeah, it's a really,
Oh
really
my
great.
God.
He's
It's like
ten octaves
it's the
below.
voice, it's the tone of the earth,
He
like
is.
in the
He is. I
Amazon.
totally agree. He connects you to something that we're not connected to. Okay, somebody, a young choreographer that you think we should all look out for.
Within the Indian classical sphere, but also some new way of storytelling, I would say Maithili Prakash.
Great, thank you. And if you were Prime Minister for just one day, what would you do for the arts or the creativity for young people? What would you do?
No, I wouldn't do it just for the arts. I would get rid of everyone and bring a bunch of storytellers, artists, and that would be including the young and the old. Just bring artists in to make sense of the world that we're living in.
Yeah.
It may be chaos, but if I had one day, that's what I would do. I would get rid of, because it's just designed to self
Oh,
one's own
you mean get rid
interests.
of all the politicians?
Absolutely.
Right. So
Oh, sorry, did
start.
I not say that? No, yes, I would get rid of all the politicians,
You said
not
get rid of
everyone.
everyone. I think a bit radical. Okay. I love this phrase. We don't measure our life by the number of breaths we take. We measure our life by the number of times our breath is taken away. When was the last time your breath was taken away?
Just recently, I watched something on YouTube, and it was an old work. I can't remember. I don't even know what it was called. It was Yuri Killian, choreographer, genius. Just took my breath away.
Well, I'll be looking at that, and this, I'm hoping that people listen to this and go away and look at these choreographers, musicians, and be inspired by the things. Obviously, be inspired by the things you've said already. So, if you can only have three words, how would you describe the Roundhouse and what it means to you?
Sacred, storytelling, refuge.
Beautiful, absolutely beautiful. So, the Akram Khan Company is no more. That takes my breath away because you've played an important role in my life. I've seen many
Oh,
of your
thank you.
shows, and I remember sitting on the sofa during the opening of the Olympic Games, and my son and I sat and saw the rings coming together as a moment of coming together, all the people in the world, the intersectionality of all of us coming together with those rings, and the singing of Abide With Me. And it was a very powerful moment, I felt. In fact, I think in many ways that Olympic Games opening and what the volunteers did showed us to be the very best of who we are. And I can't
Absolutely.
believe that over a decade later, we're not showing our best selves to the world. But that isn't the question I wanted to ask to finish with. If we had this interview in this conversation in 10 years' time, what do you think you might have done in that 10 years?
I hope in the whole 10 years coming, I hope I can still find the courage to guide people, myself included, to see the beauty in us through art, because we are at a time of darkness, and the most of us will see at night time the darkness, but a few of us will see in that darkness stars. And so I hope that those few of us, whoever those artists are or people are, who sees those stars, can get the rest of us to see that there are stars in the darkness.
Akram, thank you for making space with me today. I started the idea of these Making Space podcasts to put myself in a different position as I leave the Roundhouse, leaving on the 1st of June. I put them together because I wanted to feel uncomfortable in a different kind of way, to make myself vulnerable in a different kind of way, because I've been doing this job for 27 years. You've brought light to hundreds of thousands of people in the world. You've given me a sense of joy and understanding and deep connection, and I can't thank you enough. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Marcus.
Right.
I can't believe it. So many years. You've given so many beautiful years to the Roundhouse.
It's given me all those, Akram. I haven't given much. I feel if I've got energy every single day, and having the chance to work with people like you, it's like, who does that? What a life that is, an amazing opportunity.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much, Marcus.
It's so generous of you to make the time and to speak
No,
so
absolutely.
beautifully. You spoke from the heart, and I hope they weren't questions which you've been asked before.
No, that's why I never pause, because it's usually on automatic. The moment you ask the question, before you finish that question, I would have answered it. I would have begun to answer it. The fact that I was pausing every time, that's when you go, okay, he's not, now he's having to think. So well done. Like, yeah. That got me thinking.
Good. Yeah, I can't thank you enough.
Thank you so much.